Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
So welcome to New Books in Critical Theory, which is a podcast that's part of the New Books Network. On this episode, I'm talking to Richard Jean So about redlining culture, a data history of racial inequality and post-war fiction. So welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Dave. Thank you for having me. Really grateful for this opportunity and looking forward to our conversation.
And I'm incredibly grateful that you've written this massively important book, a book that I think does two things. One, it makes a really major contribution to our understanding of inequality and particularly racial inequality in the American publishing industry. But at the same time, I think gives a fascinating kind of set of possibilities for what I guess you'd think of as kind of well-established methods, but maybe some of our listeners might think more as kind of, you know, innovative, new and emerging computational approaches. And maybe that's the place to start, actually. I wonder if you could say a bit about the methods, the kind of approaches you had in the book and I guess why you wrote a book using this kind of computational approach.
Great question. Thanks. So scholars in English and American literature and American culture, American studies have been studying the post-war novel, post-war fiction, post-war publishing for many, many years, and the question of race. So this is a well-trodden topic in the scholarship. So one question is, why would I want to write a whole book exploring this topic that's been so well-researched and well-studied? And it's because very simply, I had some questions about this post-war period in American culture regarding racial inequality and race, particularly in light of the rise of or just the persistence of white nationalism, all these persistent racial problems and inequalities that persist that continue today. And I wanted to write a book because I wasn't really satisfied with these multiculturalism narratives, these stories and narratives of post-war American culture that really foreground the purported rise of multiculturalism. And I thought by looking at this period and looking at this question more empirically from the perspective of data that we could collect, but also more advanced statistical and computational methods like machine learning, that we could learn something new about this period and address this question of racial inequality that I feel has been not fully articulated or explained well enough in the current scholarship, which again has emphasized and foregrounded this, again, purported narrative of multiculturalism in the post-war period.
Yeah, I guess what we learn from your approach is, to be slightly kind of skeptical about narratives of progress, but because this idea of cultural redlining is what's actually been the story of post-war American literature. And I guess, to an extent, the kind of the story of post-war American publishing as much as American literature. And I was really taken by that term. Obviously, it's in the title of the book, but I guess it comes from sort of urban studies about, racial inequality and segregation in North American cities. And it'd be interesting for the listeners to hear about how you picked the title and what that cultural redlining term is doing.
Yeah, it's a term that will probably be familiar to scholars of American society, American politics. But the term comes from a series of sociological studies from the 1960s and 1970s, particularly in Chicago and Harlem. And it's a very simple set of studies where researchers went door to door in predominantly Black neighborhoods like Hyde Park in Chicago and Harlem in New York City, and just asked people their racial identification, whether they're white or Black or Asian American. And based on that, they were able to reconstruct a physical map of the likelihood of certain neighborhoods getting bank loans from local banks. And they drew lines around neighborhoods that were predominantly Black, and they found that neighborhoods that are predominantly Black and also predominantly working class were extremely unlikely to receive bank loans from the banks that were in their communities. And this term redlining came about in that implicitly, both deliberately and unconsciously, banks were drawing lines around neighborhoods that they deemed as risky or undesirable and just were refusing to give bank loans to these people who live in these communities. And this had profound, devastating economic effects for these communities in that when people can't get loans, they can't start businesses in their local communities, they can't economically develop their own communities. And this is a problem that gets compounded over time. So this is really well-known, important research in American sociology, economics, political science. I wanted to move this metaphor and this sort of approach very simply to the study of culture, in that I wanted to see if we could produce a similar kind of map for publishing book culture, literary culture, in terms of the very simple question of are the coveted resources of book contracts, book prizes, bestsellerdom, are they fairly distributed amongst white and non-white authors, or is there a similar kind of cultural redlining effect where certain communities are excluded from these resources based on their race? And I just wanted to kind of connect this question to your previous question, which is my methods are both extremely simple counting methods and also more complicated natural language processing, text mining methods. And the kind of headlining story of this, the redlining part, which is a simple counting, is that American publishing, mainstream publishing is 97% white over this period, 1950 to 2000. Book prizes are 91% white. Bestsellerdom is 98% white, which is a really staggering figure, and so forth. So that's really the redlining part, that if just by simply counting the racial demographics of post-war literary culture from publishing to bestsellers to prize winners, it's incredibly white, and there's a real redlining effect. But the other part of it is, and we can talk about this later in your questions, the less simple part of the quantitative aspect of the book is that I also really want to see what's the impact of this on the kinds of stories, the texts, the kind of books that get written in this period too. And so my redlining metaphor continues in that literature is more than just counting, you know, authors. It's more than just the identity of authors. It's also the kind of stories we tell within the fictions. So, and I find that there's this inequality that we see at the author level translates into textual, formal narrative effects within the kind of stories that get published.
It's worth also saying, you can take away, I guess, the headline of the book, which is precisely those numbers. And, you know, in some ways, those of us who are in this kind of space are like, yeah, you know, of course. But, you know, hopefully, like, you know, those of us who are not kind of, you know, sociologists of contemporary and slightly historical culture will be, you know, shocked and appalled by the sort of force of those numbers. But at the same time, you do a lot of reading in the book, and you do a lot of, I guess, kind of history telling, both of publishing houses and of authors. And if you've given the kind of perfect overview of the numbers, I wonder if you could tell me about Toni Morrison and why she matters to the book. And in some ways, the book is as much, you know, the kind of story of Toni Morrison and particularly, you know, her kind of crucial role as a publisher, gatekeeper, as a literary figure, as it is the story of, you know, Random House being 97% white for 50 years. So yeah, why was she so kind of influential in your thinking about the book?
Thanks. I'm really glad you picked up on that because I took out this paragraph where I explained Toni Morrison as the through line through all the different chapters, but I took it out because I didn't want to put that pressure on Morrison. I had this interesting debate with my editor who we just decided that making it more implicit, so kind of careful readers like yourself would pick up on the Morrison through line, but announcing it, we thought might put too much pressure on Morrison. And the book is not, again, really about Morrison, although she's the backbone. So Morrison's so important because the book really travels through four psych parts of the life cycle of post-war American fiction, which is publishing to reception, which is book reviews, and then recognition, which is book prizes and book sales. And then finally, the university, what I call consecration, which is how books are received in the university. And Morrison's so great because the argument that the overall argument I really want to stress for scholars is that these narratives, these stories we've told about the post-war period, which we rely on Morrison so much for because she's the most important, probably the most important writer of the post-war period, especially when it comes to race, that we've gotten something wrong in foregrounding her story so much. Again, the purported rise of multiculturalism. But what's really cool about Morrison is that she was also really active in all these other parts outside the academy with publishing. She was very famously an editor at Random House and led this massive campaign to introduce Black writers at the press. She was also a well-known book reviewer and her books were widely reviewed. And she was one of the very, very, very few Black writers who won book prizes and also wrote bestsellers. And I found this great quote that I start the book with from Morrison, where usually we celebrate her time, where scholars really celebrate her time at Random House as an editor to say that, you know, she completely transformed the literary field. But when you actually read her interviews, she actually says, you know, like, I didn't really accomplish that much. And she said that, you know, the real story of post-war publishing is that publishers can only really handle one Black writer per publishing house. So she says, you know, this kind of disguises this broader inequality. So I found that Morrison's own story and her own perspective, she really intuited this sort of cultural redlining. I think if she was still alive, that, you know, she would find these numbers really confirm her own intuition from her own experience working in the literary industry. And but at the same time, you know, her books were so important in transforming the literary field. It's just that, again, I find that literary scholars have, I think, perhaps overestimated the impact and focusing so much on a few exemplary minority authors. And from that, we've created these narratives of multiculturalism, which are not entirely borne out by the material and the data. So, so just Morrison, I really, you know, I thought it was perfect in that she connects the scholarly perspective with the on-the-ground perspective of what was really happening in post-war publishing and literary culture. And I find that, again, her intuition is she's so intelligent and insightful and really anticipates the kind of data map I provide of the post-war literary field, the redlining effects.
I mean, what you picked up on there, you know, that idea about what publishers can only kind of almost cope with one minority author at any one given time is almost true of reviewers as well. And the middle of the book, I think, is particularly interesting. You've talked about it, you know, as kind of reception and then, you know, moving on to, I guess, you know, ideas about value and winning prizes and so on and so forth. And I think here is an opportunity to think about the way that even where, you know, tiny numbers in comparison to their white counterparts of authors are getting through the publishing system, they're still, I suppose, running up against the wall of a particular set of expectations, a particular set of values. And this might be a good time, actually, to talk about some books, which, again, you know, is a kind of classic criticism of computational or digital humanities methods is, well, you know, what about the actual texts themselves? And you pick out Company Man, Song of Solomon, and The Joy Luck Club to think about how they were reviewed and received as ways of sort of nuancing some of your discussions, but also to kind of reinforce the barriers and I guess the kind of quite constrained expectations that in some ways allowed them to be successful, but also in other ways meant that only very, you know, kind of partial and constrained representations were able to get through reviewers' views about what a minority story is and what a minority author should be doing. So it'd be interesting to hear about either one or maybe all of those books.
Yeah, no, thank you. This is a great chance to pivot at actually talking about books, which, you know, I do a lot of close reading in the chapters. And I find the data analysis and the text mining as an occasion to reread books that we've know a lot about, but also to discover books that we don't know much about, to discover interesting outliers. So yeah, in that chapter on book reviews, so book reviews is an attention economy, and there's a lot of inequality built into that, meaning that book reviews in this period are 90 to 91% white. But the bigger problem, which you alluded to, is book reviewers, even within that inequality, which is pretty severe, they only tend to even only talk about specific kinds of novels written by minority authors, which gives the illusion that they are giving more attention to minority writers, where, you know, 90% is better than 97%, which is what happens in publishing. But even with that marginal improvement in inequality, the chapter argues that the range of white authors that get book reviewed is incredibly broad. I use this measurement called a Gini coefficient, which economists use to show that if you're a white author or if you're a book reviewer, the range of different kinds of books by white authors you would review, from, say, science fiction to literary fiction, is incredibly broad. Whereas the range of book reviews that talk about Black writers is incredibly narrow. It's really like Toni Morrison, you know, and today it would be like Colson Whitehead. And I do some close reading. I compare a book that was widely reviewed by book reviewers in this period, Song of Solomon, actually the most reviewed novel by a non-white writer, again, a book by Toni Morrison, again, Song of Solomon, as exemplar of the kind of book that book reviewers use to represent Black literature, versus this other book that I found in the data, which is a really cool book. It's called Company Man by Brett Wade. And unless you are an expert on this period's Black literature, you probably have never heard of this writer. But I found that he was pretty widely reviewed in the Black press, but completely not reviewed in the white press or the kind of elite, you know, like New Yorker or New York Times. So it's a really striking contrast. So I do close readings of Song of Solomon versus Company Man to say, like, you know, like, like, what's their difference, right? Why is one book deemed to represent Black literature, say the Black experience, and this other book is deemed to not? And what I find through the close reading is, I mean, they're really different, obviously, but I think the important thing is that Song of Solomon is, the two major things I would say is, what's distinctive about Company Man is that it's about a Black gay man. So that's really distinctive in that a lot of the novels that are celebrated that by Black writers in this period tend not to foreground Black masculinity or Black homosexuality. And the more subtle thing, though, is really about style. And the elite press really valorizes a kind of Black postmodern, how do I describe this? A specific non-literal form of writing, whereas Company Man, it's an epistolary, and it really eschews elaborate metaphors, figurations. It's really quite literal, and when it talks about things like wealth or race, it uses really literal images, like a Lamborghini. Whereas in Song of Solomon, famously, Toni Morrison uses this image of this kind of bag of gold, which is obviously meant to be highly metaphorical or allegorical. It's not really like a bag of gold, right? And, you know, and I just find that, which is fine, you know, like, you know, critics can like what they like, but the problem is it further intensifies that inequality of the 90% versus 10%, because it says that only one kind of Black writer can stand for the Black experience. Because Brent Waite's story is also a story of Black America, and the way he writes is also how Black writers write. And that, to me, is an important part of this redlining story, that it's not only are you excluding just quantitatively Black writers, you're only saying a very, very tiny handful of Black writers are even worth anyone's attention.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, I think this is especially crucial because both in the kind of academic literature, but I think we're you know, usefully actually seeing it in media or popular sort of social media discussions, you know, a sense of a kind of a white set of reviewers, or perhaps, you know, a kind of a monocultural system for making value judgments about literature, inevitably. And actually the same is true of cinema and music. You know, we're seeing these debates across what we call it, the cultural industries in the UK. It means that the breadth of stories, as you say, becomes narrow. The kinds of voices are almost deemed acceptable or not to quite a narrow, in some cases, set of stereotypes. And you talk about them quite a lot, actually, in the first chapter around what we might think of as kind of negative, or, you know, to be more blunt about it, quite racist stereotypes in a variety of different settings across Random House's output. I suppose the other element of contemporary worries and the book, you know, obviously picks this up from a historical perspective about having, you know, a largely kind of, you know, white reviewer base, or you know, a kind of a narrow set of expectations about what's acceptable as a minority or as a Black American novel, is mirrored in contemporary discussions about who gets what in terms of prizes, but also who gets what in terms of sales. And again, you know, the middle of the book tries to kind of think through the relationship between race, sales, and then literary prizes. And I wonder if you could kind of extend the analysis for me through those two categories, really, in terms of, you know, what will shift, to be crude, shift units, but then what will be, you know, kind of valorized and given value through prizes.
The surprising thing I found in this chapter, where I look at bestsellers and prize winners, the argument that I find there is it definitely continues the argument that I found in the book review chapter, which is a very specific kind of novel by a non-white writer tends to be valorized in the prize system, but the the counterintuitive argument that really foreground in this chapter on recognition, or what sociologists, you guys, would call distinction, is there's this, I find that scholars, when they talk about distinction from a Bourdieuian perspective, really tend to foreground this distinction between high and low. So high is like literary fiction or A24 movies, right? And low or middle brow is stuff like Avengers, right? Or, you know, popular music. But I found that when I add this third category in terms of a quantitative analysis of a corpus of novels written by Black authors, this corpus that has been developed by scholars at the University of Kansas, that the real story of post-war literary distinction, or again, that the making of high and low, is really this intense anti-Blackness that it's true that, you know, prize winners, they periodically allow novels by minority writers to win, you know, win prizes. But when you look at the full system, what, again, Bourdieu calls a literary field, the making of high and low, they are less different from each other and more similar to each other in their rejection of Blackness. And I find this both in the demographic data that they're just prize winners are 91% white in this period and bestsellers are 98% white. But even before, beyond that, and this is where the sort of machine learning text mining method becomes quite useful. I find that in terms of the kinds of stories they prefer, the tropes or whatever, that they are really similar, again, bestsellers and prize winners, in their aversion to tropes, narratives, story types, themes that are very specific and particular to novels by Black writers. So we can definitely talk about prize winningness and minority-ness, but the story that I really want to tell in that chapter is, whether you're looking at bestsellers or prize winners, I think it would surprise people to know that, again, they are more similar to each other than different in their mutual aversion to Blackness. And I guess the way that I might be able to connect this more directly to your question is when prize winners give novels to, say, Black writers, yeah, they have a very specific kind of Black story that they have in mind. Again, like book reviewers. And that's a tiny part of Black literature. That taste is very similar to bestsellerdom, and that's why there's so few Black bestsellers.
One way of thinking through all of this, I guess, is that this is a story of the publishing industry and kind of, you know, failures. And, you know, you flag Bourdieu and the kind of the literary field, but I think there is, you know, a story, and it runs through Morrison and her role as a publisher as well as a writer as well. But it's a story of, I guess, a kind of, you know, a set of institutional failures of the publishing industry. At the same time, I was incredibly taken with, and you know, this is partially because I'm an academic, but I was incredibly taken with the final chapter, which talked about the university, the role of, you know, whether we call it the reading list or the canon, or you know, what is taught and what is given kind of status. And what was fascinating about this was, on the one hand, you present a historical analysis of this period, this moment called that you refer to as the canon wars over contemporary, as was contemporary literature. But then at the same time, you're telling a story of this continued, almost, you know, kind of perpetual racial inequality that is just there in the publishing industry, that, you know, irrespective of what academics are saying matters and what has value, you know, the same kind of problems that you'd identified at the beginning of the period the book covers are there right at the very end. And I wonder if you could kind of unpack that, you know, that strange kind of divergence, really, you know, as institutions that tell us what is valuable are engaged in, you know, really kind of serious struggles to kind of change what counts and what doesn't. the industry that is, you know, kind of providing them with the material is not changing at all very much.
Yeah, it's funny. I have so much to say about this because I'm also an academic, you know, and I think we can, you and I can talk about this quite a bit. I guess the way I would reframe my response is, this book, I guess, has two major arguments. One is really about the publishing industry. And I would agree with your take that all these problems begin with the publishing industry, that the problems we see in bestsellerdom and, you know, prizes, they flow from, you know, the publishing industry's problems. So the first major argument of the book is something about institutional failure. And that's the reception to that has been really cool. I've talked to a lot of writers who have had a chance to read the book, and I wrote an op-ed in the New York Times where I sort of summarized some of the book's arguments. So that part, I think, is really for people who study this stuff, and also for writers and editors and publishers. That's really the substantive part of the argument. But as you point out, the other part of the argument is really for academics. It's sort of a meta critique of the way that we studied this problem. And again, I just find a lot of problems that help perpetuate the problem when, you know, the people charged to understand the problem have not really understood the problem correctly. And and I guess most of the people listening to this podcast are academics. So, you know, this is a little bit wonky, but I do want to get into it because I think it's important because, as you say, even if this is about a story about academics, we're in charge of determining what kinds of books and works of culture have value, which have social ramifications. So just to summarize a major argument, which is a very strong argument, and I think the most polemical part that people have been responding to, I basically take on 30 years of scholarship to say that we've completely misread this post-war period, and the so-called canon wars were very successful in impacting the academy, but were extremely ineffective in transforming the cultural field. And the obvious paradox here is the canon wars, their purpose was to really have impact on society, not just change the academy. But the argument I make is that we've mistaken these changes that we see locally in the academy, partly because we're in the academy, this is what we see every day, for progress in society more generally, which is a problem because if nothing is changing in the bigger social world, it doesn't really matter what's really changing the academy, at least in my opinion. I think what happens in the academy is of second order interest to what happens in society. And the bigger problem is in that misunderstanding then helps perpetuate this, the bigger problem, in that if we believe the problem has been solved, we stop actively working on it. We just believe things are okay. The book mounts just Marshall's tremendous evidence to say that this multiculturalism narrative, and I have all these quotes, you know, non-ironic quotes by leading scholars to say that, you know, multiculturalism was a victory, et cetera. And the scholarship has turned into a direction to say that, how successful was multiculturalism, you know, multiculturalism, you know, is itself problematic as a term. But again, the problem is that we assume something happened in society. Right, and now we're left with a sort of meta critique over terminology and, you know, critique over the language of diversity and so forth. But again, assumes that something did happen, and again, I marshal a lot of evidence to say that maybe nothing happened, and that's a significant problem that we're living with today. And again, I think that's why in the current moment we've been so blindsided by things like Oscar So White, Publishing So White, because, you know, we're surprised. We're saying like, oh, we thought, you know, that all worked out by the 90s, you know, that everything was fixed. And people, again, I think are caught off their back heels, you know, shocked at this, you know, so-called rise of, you know, white nationalism and culture. And again, I think what my history shows is that it never went anywhere. You know, it's not a resurgence. It's just the continuance that we're only starting to notice again. And again, I think that this problem has to be addressed. And I'd be happy to talk to you about, you know, I've had a lot of interesting debates with people on Twitter and social media where, I think one response has been, you know, people buy the argument, but people still say, you know, what we do as scholars is really important. The canon wars were really important. I just, my own perspective is I'm dubious of that position. I think what we do as scholars is important, but to say that it's, I think we just overstate its importance, that if we're not actively having impact on society, then we're failing in some way. But I've had a lot of, you know, good faith arguments and debates with people on social media, other professors to say that, who really believe that, you know, social progress in the university is really, really important. And the canon wars were really successful. But again, I just disagree.
Yeah, it's tricky, isn't it? That, you know, which literary works are kind of selected, not just to be valued, but, you know, you've used that kind of crucial term, to, you know, to be consecrated and, you know, to be given the kind of status as being, you know, worthy of not just study, but, you know, almost institutionalization in some cases as being, you know, core text or standard readings or whatever, you know, really does matter to what is valued in society and which, you know, stories, which social groups, et cetera, et cetera. At the same time, there is this persistent problem of just a lack of change in the publishing industry. And again, you know, it's interesting that the things you flagged with these broader cultural production shocks, like, you know, Oscar So White or whatever, and, you know, to an extent, there are other parts of the academy that are kind of saying, yeah, of course, that's how the system works. Why would you expect anything to be different at all? And my inner cultural sociologist is like, well, we should finish there. That's a great kind of moment to conclude on. But I think that would do a slight injustice to the book. And, you know, I've stressed this repeatedly throughout our conversation, that this is still, you know, a literature book. You know, this is still a humanities book. And that really comes to the fore if we return to Morrison. And in particular, you kind of offer a close reading of Beloved by Toni Morrison, almost as a way of kind of like talking about computational methods, which I found fascinating and intriguing. And, you know, if we're thinking about digital humanities, if we're thinking about quantitative analysis, a close reading would not be the kind of first place we might start. We'd probably start with, you know, the numbers we talked about, you know, the kind of lack of change over time, the, you know, particular terms that come up repeatedly with, you know, negative connotations, etc., based on race. So I suppose I've got a kind of a two-parter. One is, you know, what is your reading of Morrison's Beloved and how do you use it to think through computational methods? But I suppose I'm also intrigued as to why you rounded up, why you kind of finished the book with that, you know, as I might speculate, as a way of kind of returning to literary studies, maybe as a way of kind of, you know, reminding potential readers that this is still, you know, kind of literary studies. It's not comp sci or cultural sociology.
Yeah, thanks for that. I've been looking forward to our conversation, Dave, because you're a sociologist. And as we were talking about before we started this conversation, if this book can be of interest or of use to social scientists at all, that would be awesome. I was actually inspired by a couple great cultural sociology books from the 80s that were much more sociological. They were studies of the book industry and were very interview heavy. And I think there's another version of this book that'd be really cool that does more of that, you know, ethnographic, really rigorous sociological work. Like, questions that my book does not answer are things like, what about agents, right? Like, why aren't there more Black editors, right? Like, what are the sociological processes that, you know, like much more on the ground institutional. So thanks for that. And I really think, yeah, there's another version of this book that would be great. That's much more richly sociological, but it's true that it's mainly for humanities, literature and cultural studies folks. And yeah, as you intuit, I end the book with a close reading of Toni Morrison's Beloved, which for many reasons that we've been talking about, and I talk about this in the book as well, is really the most important book, post-war American novel about race. And I ended partly strategically in that I wanted to remind readers, even skeptical readers, that this problem at heart is a problem about reading books and interpretation and meaning in specific novels. But beyond just strategically, I found Morrison's novel a great book to end with, in that to me it models in really interesting ways the kind of methods and insights that the book more broadly is trying to advance, including the quantitative parts. And I guess I would mention most specifically that probably the most, one of the most famous lines that scholars always talk about is this line where a character says, if you can't read, they can beat you. And scholars have taken this as a call in the 80s and 90s as like the power of reading, right? That by reading text in a new way, this goes back to the Canon Wars, that you can disturb conventional conventional thought, that you can really resist regimes of power and so forth, that reading is a really empowering process. But what really blew my mind is that literally the next line in the novel that the character speaks is, if you can't count, they can cheat you. And I just spent a lot of time in scholarship, and it blew my mind that scholars always cite the first part of that quote about reading and completely ignore the second part about the importance of counting and the importance of math and quantitative reasoning. And that to me seemed like such a great analogy or, you know, metaphor for the lacuna in the scholarship that we've, you know, we've taken Beloved as the rallying cry for a contemporary study of race and culture. Like, Morrison's Beloved is so important, and it models a way of reading as really central to the humanities as a way to critique racial inequality and racial oppression. But again, all along in this novel, there's been literally in the next sentence, right, testifying to the importance of quantitative analysis and quantitative reasoning. And I just, through my close reading of Morrison, I really want to draw that out to say, like, hey, like, this novel that is at the center of these narratives of multiculturalism and literally the reason why we exist as scholars of literature and race is asking us to also combine qualitative and quantitative forms of reasoning and critique. And I thought it would be really convincing to, you know, end with this novel that, you know, scholars we all love so much and is so important to us, is so foundational for what we do, to say, you know, bringing all this quantitative and computational methods is really not alien at all to American fiction, to Morrison, to Black writing. It's been there all along. And, you know, I thought it would be most convincing to end the book by saying or showing how these new methods, they don't have to disrupt or unravel everything that we've been doing for 30 years or, you know, with this body of literature, that it's really a synthesis of perspectives that to me are innate or imminent within American fiction, the thing that we study. So that's why I did it.
Just to wrap up, this is probably seems a bit of a mean question given you've produced this wonderful new book, but what are you working on next? The kind of, you know, the academic question is never, you know, how do you think this book has gone? It's always, so what are you doing next? And in that spirit, what are you doing next? I mean, it strikes me that there's a rich set of possibilities in these computational approaches, but equally, I can imagine that, you know, a book like this might give you the kind of moment to say, well, you know, I've gone in that direction, maybe I'll do something else.
Yeah, it's a little bit of both. I feel done with post-war fiction publishing for now. It's funny, that's, you know, as you know, Dave, people always want you to talk about the thing that you did like 5 years ago, which is kind of frustrating, you know. But yeah, I feel pretty done with this set of issues. I'm really most interested in lived contemporary culture, how people are experiencing it. I wanted to work on something a little bit more canonical with a redlining book, because I thought that a good way to introduce controversial new methods is to work on stuff that is super canonical, what a lot of people care about. But I'm kind of done with that. And I'm just really excited, like a lot of other people, about, you know, social media, the internet, user-generated content. And I feel like these methods are so obviously well-suited for at scale, like massive amounts of textual data. But it's a continuation of the redlining book insofar as this question of inequality, how it plays out in a different kind of institutional context, what you could call the internet, right? The so-called whiteness of the internet and cultural production, in a new milieu where ordinary, you know, millions of ordinary people are empowered to write fiction. I guess the question I have is, you know, when you open up the gates of culture to everybody, so like Reddit, Twitter, Wattpad, fan fiction, all that stuff, how does that change older dynamics of racial inequality? So, yeah, I'm working on a bunch of projects that are looking at internet platforms, user-generated content, but still thinking about this question of race and racial inequality. Specifically, you know, is the internet a horrible place? Like, certainly it is in some ways, you know, but is it also an empowering place where, you know, new perspectives more easily can enter the discourse? I guess like this massive question that everyone cares about, right? Like, what is the internet doing to our cultural discourse? That's kind of where I'm heading right now. And yeah, it's both, I feel kind of done with publishing in fiction, but is a continuation of the conceptual questions I study in the book.